2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This is the beginning of the technical net. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and I, for the last 5 years or so, have tried to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets here most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and almost everything connected to it. You heard me say to Don many times that, in my opinion, a true ham radio operator is a kind of a scientist. And so you'll hear guys talking about, for the first hour, the more mundane kinds of ham radio, antennas, transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, propagation, satellites, moon bounce, meteor scatter. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and we discuss many of those. We do that by having people sign in with their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. Probably 95% of the time, the subjects that are discussed during the first hour, maybe even during the first 2 hours, are the subjects that are brought as questions. Rarely do we have a canned subject. There's a lot of brain power in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, and we try to tap into that. So quite often somebody will ask a question, and by the way, the people can also sign in by way of internet techniques, IRLP and Echolink. And according to Mike Perry, the man who runs the website that records all of this, you can play back those recordings for the last, 2006 until now. That's what, five and a half years Mike Perry's been doing that. So lots of information there, and quite a bit of it is documented as to what subject was discussed during each 10-minute period of time. So we try to tap into that brain power, and quite often a person will hear a subject being discussed they know something about, they chime in and give us the benefit of their wisdom. Not everything you hear on the TechNet is 100% accurate at first. It's a kind of a peer-reviewed journal, you could say, we're writing here. We tell each other our best thoughts of what we think, what we know, what we believe, what experience has told us, and then that all gets recorded. And next week, the errors, if they're there, people will point them out to us. So eventually it all gets straightened out, it says here. But not everything is 100% accurate at first. That's the nature of research. You could say these guys are trying to do a kind of pure research. We're all struggling a little bit. I mean, how a radio wave really gets generated by that antenna, how it really gets launched by that antenna, and how it propagates into space, into completely free space. And if you did an experiment like I did, let me drop. For about a two-year period of time, I was doing a lot of work at the Rome Air Development Center in Utica, New York, or near Utica, New York, and I was traveling up there every weekend with a 180-watt Mirage amplifier on 2 meters in my car, a couple of very simple 5/8 wave whip and a halo antenna on the car, and I would flip back and forth between the two. And I was holding sideband QSOs with K2TXB, Russ Pillsbury, in southern New Jersey while I'm passing by Albany, New York, essentially 200 miles away. And when I traveled west on Route 90 to get to Utica, I'm on the northern side of the Adirondack Mountains, and he's way down there in southern New Jersey, 200 miles away, and we were holding sideband QSOs mobile. How in the world was that signal getting there? Anyway, they were 95% copy. Yeah, he was running a moon bounce array, an array of four good high-gain Yagis and a kilowatt of power on 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey. That helped an awful lot, without a doubt. But I had very simple antennas in my car. I had a horizontal and vertical antenna. I could flip back and forth between the two. He was transmitting pure horizontal. He sounded equal on horizontal and vertical. By the time that signal sifted to all of those trees and buildings and earth curvature and everything else and got to me 200 miles away down at sea level, so to speak, in my automobile, how in the world is that signal getting there? You and I could speculate about that for a long time to come. There's a whole lot of art and science there, if you know what I mean. Just gives you an idea of some of what goes on in ham radio. A person signs in. Let me drop. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Something else I was going to say, but I thought, I forgot it. Oh, yeah, I'm going to be correcting one of the things we said last week. Also, there was a beautiful experiment done in CERN, Switzerland, over to Italy, which appears to be showing greater than the speed of light of neutrinos traveling through 731 kilometers of Earth. And we might discuss that a little bit later. During the first hour, we people who sign in at first, we try to answer everyone's question at least briefly during the first hour. And therefore, in theory, you don't have to wait longer than an hour to get at least a partial answer. Beyond the first hour, Paul, WS2N, will tell us what NASA has been doing. Melody's available, will tell us the new recruits, what they've been sending him on emails and snail mails. And after that, we get into the deeper subjects. And we're probably going to get into a little bit of what's going on at CERN. Also, there's a beautiful program on NASA on the nature of the cosmos, so to speak, and the most recent program on I said NASA, I meant NOVA, NOVA program on PBS, on the nature of empty space. You'll be amazed how space empty is. I'm talking about inside of the molecules that are in the room with you right now. You wouldn't believe how much empty space there is there. And that NOVA program gives you some idea as to how important empty space is. There's a lot to be learned, as you can tell. So once again, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in to let us know that you are listening. After 29 years of the TechNet, this is TechNet number 1372, we sort of believe there must be somebody listening. And Mike on his website has told us that 198 out
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
JXM.
Okay, Mr. JXM. N2JXM, that was that? And what's your name, sir?
That's Gary, KB2JXM. And speaking about the speed of light, and my question would be that you have, say, a bad SWR, you got standing waves sticking out 90 degrees from the coax. Wouldn't that be twice the speed of light?
A very deep question. We're only taking the check-ins right now. Good guess, Gary, but absolutely not. And we'll get into that. So Gary's our first sign-in. Anyone else who sign in, give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now, which means you do have a question or a comment.
And who we are, Rich and yes.
We got Rich. We got Gary. Who else? One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Audio as well.
I heard KC2 Mike Yankee, and the only reason I could hear you, sir, is because I'm wearing earphones. Your audio is about 20 decibels low. So if you can correct that by turning up the gain, or maybe your finger was over the hole on the microphone, or maybe you were speaking into the back of the mic, and please tell me your name. KC2 Mike Yankee, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Name is Ray. Radio usually works fine. How is it now?
Ray usually works fine, Ray. We could hear you, but I'm wearing earphones, and your audio is 20 decibels low. Don't give up. If you can't correct it between now and the time I get to you, you're the third guy on our list. I will simply listen to what you say and repeat your words so that everybody else knows it. But if you can correct that audio between now and then, it would be helpful. As I said, your audio is 20 decibels low. Anyone else to check in? One last call, K2RIW. Another person with extremely low audio. Reasonable RF, but extremely low audio. Shout into that mic and I might be able to figure out who you are.
N2PPV.
Okay, I heard N2PPV. It sounds like Papa Papa Victor. Very low audio. And what is your name, sir?
Artie.
Okay, Artie, we got you. Alrighty, the first guy who signed in was Gary, KB2JXN. And Gary, I think you're saying that in the case of standing wave ratio, and by the way, everybody thinks that when you measure the standing wave ratio of an antenna, you're really measuring how well its impedance matched. If everything was real well, the antenna would present a 50-ohm resistive load to the end of the cable. All the signal that your transmitter generates would go down that cable, be absorbed by the antenna and radiate in space. And people think that a standing wave ratio bridge is measuring impedance mismatch. And it's measuring a lot more than that. The main thing it's measuring is reverse power ratio, or reflected power ratio. All the power gets absorbed as 50-ohm load. If your antenna is higher or lower than 50 ohms resistive, and if it has any reactance to its impedance, if it acts a little bit like a capacitor or an inductor, a certain percentage of the energy that you send up to the antenna doesn't get absorbed by the antenna. That's just the way transmission lines work. And so some of it gets reflected back. And so the reflected energy, we call it the reverse power ratio. We call it, in a case of a network analyzer, it's called scattering parameter S11 is what it's called, reverse voltage reflection coefficient, which has an amplitude and phase. It's a vector. So by measuring how much power comes back, measure what phase angle is the power that comes back, that in theory gives you all the information you know, all you need to figure out exactly what is the antenna impedance, how much is it mismatched, and do you want to bother making a correction. But let me give you one of the two facts before I turn it back over to Gary for to hear a little bit more about his question. Let me drop. And by the way, the guys talking to the TechNet, sometimes when we really get rolling, we get hot and heavy, we get extremely excited, and we talk on top of each other. Let's make a sincere attempt to really wait for all four of the beeps before you talk, because if we don't properly reset the machines, then the people who are listening on internet or are listening out east on the 375 machine, 147.375, they get timed out. They don't hear the rest of the conversation, and it's kind of annoying to them. And we cause that by talking on top of each other. So try to not do that, even though you guys have got a lot of enthusiasm. Try to wait for all four beeps. And on top of that, there's one other thing that keeps happening. And that is from time to time, you'll hear people who are disruptive. You'll hear somebody who puts in a dead carrier, puts in extraneous noise, music, whatever. What's going on there, in my opinion, we don't address them. We just go on with and ignore them as best we can. It's a person who's unhappy with his life, in my opinion. He hears us having fun discussing our favorite subject and educating each other, and that person thinks that if he disrupts them, he's going to be happier. It's a sad state of affairs. It doesn't really work. It's not going to make him happier. He thinks so. And he thinks because he's anonymous, he's going to have some fun. Hopefully, a smarter person will eventually find out that that doesn't work. He'll also notice something else that happens at around 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. We stop making the measurement of the input. In other words, when you hear things that are disruptive, you should flip to the input frequency on your receiver and figure out how strong is the signal strength and report that to Len, K2IVX, who collects that information. So whenever you hear disruptive information, listen to the input, tell us how strong is the signal in your area. That'll tell us something about where it's coming from. And we have to keep doing that even up to 11 o'clock at night when somebody likes to put out a weak carrier, hoping to time out the machine. So we have to keep doing that, if you know what I mean. Now, getting back to standing wave ratio, one more thing I was going to tell you. Is that reflected power, the ratio in the phase angle, tells you what the antenna impedance is, and it tells you, once you know the length of the transmission line, it tells you that, if you've got the right kind of instrumentation. The main thing we care about is the magnitude. And you would think at first that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is the highest you can tolerate. And certain transmitters, our no-tune transmitters these days, won't tolerate a lot more than 2-to-1. Otherwise, they start turning off the final stage or cutting back in power to do self-protection. But a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, as bad as it sounds, still 89% of the power is going in the right direction. Only 11% of the power is being reflected. That's a half a decibel of loss. That's very tolerable. It's not until you get up to a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio do you have half the power being reflected and half the power being lost, so to speak. And so standing wave ratio, although some of our rigs are very sensitive to it, is nowhere near as bad as you think. But now, if you use a time domain reflectometer, that's sort of a radar in a cable. Let me drop. If you really had a good, properly calibrated time domain reflectometer, and if you had an antenna that's not presenting a good 50 ohm impedance, the time domain reflectometer puts out a brief pulse. The pulse goes down the cable, hits the antenna. If the antenna is not a pure 50 ohm resistor, very broadband, a certain amount of the power gets reflected back. The time domain reflectometer, acting like a radar, measures that reflected power, tells you how many nanoseconds downrange it was. In other words, it measures the timing. And I've used time domain reflectometers a lot in my life, and I can tell you for a fact, Gary, that if you had 50 feet of cable, and the speed of light is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. So if it was 50 feet of airline having a velocity factor of unity, 50 feet of airline, there would be 50 nanoseconds of time delay from the time the pulse comes out of your transmitter until it gets to the antenna. Of whatever portion of the pulse gets reflected back, another 50 nanoseconds would be required for the pulse reflecting off the antenna to come back down that airline cable of my example and come back to the transmitter. So you're at the transmitter with your time domain reflectometer. You would measure 100 nanoseconds of round trip delay time if it was airline. And if you were using a polyethylene cable like RG8, let me drop. Because that's got a velocity factor of 66%, you take that 100 nanoseconds I just gave as an example, divide by 0.66, and it would be, maybe the number is 135 nanoseconds. You would really measure 135 nanoseconds of return time of the pulses or anything else that you're sending that you could use as timing. So reflected energy on a cable obeys the normal speed of light. It's not going to be like a neutrino that travels 20 parts per million too fast. It doesn't do that. And one of the magics of transmission lines, which is hard to believe, is that the signal going forward on the transmission line and the signal coming back from the antenna on that same transmission line, even though they came from the same transmitter, those two signals in those two directions do not see each other. They do not react with each other in any way. It's very similar to the radio waves that are in the room with you right now that are coming from five different broadcast stations. All those waves are plowing through the air in your room in various directions, and those individual waves do not see each other. They don't interact in any way, and that happens on your transmission line. Of course, that defies common sense. It doesn't make sense at first. Take my word for it. After you study it enough, I think you're going to probably come to that conclusion, Gary. Now, tell me your real question, because I made a bunch of guesses, as you can tell. KB2, JXN, K2RIW. You got it, Gary. Gary, are you still there? KB2JXN? He's the guy who asked the original question, and maybe I talked on so long I put him to sleep. One last Gary. Cool. Are you still there, Gary? Now, standing wave ratio is one of the most misunderstood concepts in all of ham radio. You and I could go tuning across the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and you're going to find somebody standing on his soapbox telling you his theory of standing wave ratio. You'd be amazed how many guys will say, if I adjust the transmission line to just the right length, and in his mind, the right length might be some fraction of a quarter wavelength, some multiple of a half wavelength, some multiple of a wavelength, some odd multiple, some even multiple. You'd be amazed how many theories there are of people who think that if they simply change the length of their transmission line, they will change the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. I'll bet you 20% of the hams in the world believe that nonsense. Sounds like good common sense, and you can make a measurement with less than perfect equipment that when you interpret the measurement, you would think that that is the right answer. It's not. So before we leave the standing wave ratio subject and go to sign-in person number 2. Anyone else have any further questions or comments on the subject of standing wave ratio, reflected power from an antenna, signals traveling on a transmission line? If you have any further questions or comments on this, give me your call letters right now and your name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W1DTH. Mike.
Me again for my twice the speed of light thing.
Okay, W1DTH recognized. I'm going to get to you, Mike. Gary was the guy who asked the original question, And so maybe you're back in range now, Gary. Go right ahead with your twice the speed of light question that relates to standing wave ratio. You got it, Gary. Wait for all four beeps first.
Okay. Now, my question was, and I agree with you about the 250 nanoseconds and timing. They miss each other. So either on its way back on the return trip is where your standing waves are being created, or we have, I'm just kind of thinking that maybe we have twice the speed of light on the return trip in order to produce the standing waves.
Yeah, you said something, Gary, that is good common sense, and a lot of people will agree with you, that the signal being returned from the antenna, because the antenna is not exactly a 50-ohm resistor, that the returning signal creates the standing wave. To a degree, that's true. If I was using a slotted line, for instance, or electro wires, I would move that probe along the slotted line. I would find a peak in one spot, a valley in another spot, and the ratio between the two, for years and years, was called the standing wave ratio, because that was the best way of measuring it. And you think that the standing wave is being created by the reflected power. To a degree, it's true. However, the indication of the standing wave, the peak in the valley, was created inside of the probe with the rectifier network that was in that probe of your slotted line or your electro wire system. That's where the real standing wave is created, because there, for the first time, inside of your probe, the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal got mixed together. The transmission line, believe it or not, does not do that. The transmission line keeps completely separate the signal that's flowing up the cable from the signal that's flowing down the cable, and keeps them thoroughly separate. They don't interact in any way, and up to the point where you're still using the transmission line in a linear manner. If it was an airline and you're putting such a great big signal in there that the transmission line is arcing over, which means it has a non-linearity to it, yes, it'll now do mixing. It'll now do all kinds of funny things. But up until that point, it keeps them completely separate. It's not until that reflected signal hits your instrumentation that you see what you and I call the standing wave ratio, reflected power ratio, and so on. But the delay time going up the cable, the delay time coming back down, they two add together in a linear addition manner. If it took 50 nanoseconds...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If it took 50 nanoseconds for the signal to go up the cable, it's going to take another 50 nanoseconds for the signal to come back down, the reflected signal. So there is no faster than speed of light in normal transmission lines normal cables and normal instrumentation. There's a slight catch to that. The magic of waveguide is that the signal goes down the waveguide not by going down the center of the guide just like the signal from your eye does. The real radio signal going down a waveguide wiggles back and forth like scissors. It bounces back and forth on the narrow walls of the waveguide. Because it is bouncing back and forth at a very specific angle, depending on the frequency and the size of the guide, it takes a longer period of time for the signal to get there, because it's going by a zigzag path. That's what happens to what's called group delay, or group delay velocity. But because of the funny way that the signals add up in phase, the phase velocity looks like it's faster than the speed of light. You see a little bit of that effect when you watch a wave crashing against the shore at a beach, and if the wave is almost parallel with the beach, the rate at which the wave is breaking, when you look at it, the breaking from east to west, so to speak, the breaking speed is faster than the speed at which the wave is moving through the water. That's just an artifact. It's a visual effect that looks like it's faster than the speed of light, so to speak. It's not. But waveguide has that characteristic when you measure phase velocity. You've got to be careful how you use that, because at first you'll think that the signal is getting there faster than the speed of light. It really isn't. Gary, if you've got any other comments, I think you might be back out of range. K2RIW, N2XJN, KB2XJN. You got it, Gary.
It's KB2JXM, Michael. Michael. Okay, the only other question I have is, what did you mean by probe? Is that the SWR meter?
If you were a lot younger than you are, Gary, you would remember way back in the dark ages when the microwave people used to always measure standing wave ratio with an instrument called a slotted line, Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line, if I remember the number correctly. And it was a kind of a great big coaxial cable with literally a slot along the longitudinal dimension. And you took this, what looked like a piece of wire that stuck down into that slot, and it sampled some of the signal that was flowing down the semiconductor. It didn't touch the semiconductor. It went close to the semiconductor, sampled some of that signal, put it into a rectifier. That probe that went into the slot of the line was on a kind of a carriage, and you could wheel this carriage along the line of this slotted line piece of test equipment, and it had calibrated box along the side, measured in inches or centimeters, usually centimeters, and by measuring the number of centimeters difference between the peaks and the valleys, you could figure out the frequency, you could figure out the phase angle, and so on. So inside of that probe that went into that slot of that coaxial cable, of that piece of test equipment, yes, there was a rectifier, and that's where the standing wave first got created. On the transmission line itself, I say it wasn't there, but now we're into semantics. Not everyone's going to agree with me on that. It's a matter of definition of the words. But standing wave ratio is a darn good subject to discuss because it is highly misunderstood. And boy, the number of erroneous comments that people can make on this subject is pretty high. Now back to you for a final, Gary. KB2, Julia X-ray, Mike, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Very good. I'm not familiar with that piece of equipment. I haven't even heard of it. All I had was an SWR meter or an SWR bridge, and that's all I ever used. Of course, I had different ones. But being that I don't have that, and all I had was an SWR meter, would the SWRs start changing at the point of the SWR meter, or only with this 805 piece of equipment?
What most people use nowadays, because the slotted line was a great big piece of equipment, not very convenient, nowadays we use a network analyzer, a Bird wattmeter, a directional coupler, a impedance bridge. We use all other kinds of things. And yes, you could say the standing wave is now created inside of that instrumentation, because in order for it to figure out how much power was going forward and how much power is coming back, it is rectifying that RF energy, putting into a mixer, diode of some kind, a diode, which is doing both mixing and rectifying, detecting. And so you could say the standing wave ratio is created there. But I'll warn you, we're getting into semantics now. Your Bird wattmeter really is a kind of directional coupler, and when you have it in the forward mode, it's picking up the amount of power flowing in the forward direction, rectifying it, and plugging it into your meter. And then when you go to the reverse mode, you're just taking that exact same directional coupler, switching it 180 degrees by rotation, and now in theory it's only sensitive to the power flowing in the other direction if it's well calibrated. And when you change the length of the transmission line between your transmitter and the antenna, under some conditions you will think the measured standing wave ratio on your impedance bridge, your Bird wattmeter, whatever, you will think it's changing, and you will think that the change of the length of the line changed the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. If you see that effect, 90% of the time, it is an error in your instrumentation. Real transmission lines don't do that, on the assumption that the new cable you're adding is the same impedance as the rest of the cable. So bear in mind that you cannot, in the real world, change standing wave ratio by simply changing the length of the cable. There's a lot more to the standing wave ratio story, and we'll be going through it for the next 10 years if the TechNet lasts that long. Good question, Gary. Glad you asked.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's a good question. Glad you asked, but I better move on to the next person so we don't violate our virtual promise of trying to get to everybody during the first hour. Rich, N2EO, what's going on in Whitestone tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Vic. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, NCEO. Vic, I wanted to discuss VHF amplifier design. First off, I wanted to give you an update on the 680 kilowatt, which is done. I got a few things just to loosen up on it, but it's working 100%. Some of the problems I had, I was driving the thing, I eliminated those chokes and the capacitors that the kid put from the grid to ground. Grounded the grid directly, I'm getting 65 watts of drive, it's giving me 800 watts out. I go up to about 90, 95 watts of drive, I'm getting 1100 watts out on 6 meters. This is the SB220 that I converted to 6. A couple of other problems I overcame. I had a connection going from the plate. The antenna was tied there, and between that and the circulating tank current, they were so high that that terminal was burning up on me. So what I ended up doing is taking a piece of a half-inch wide strap. There were four terminals, two in the front, two in the back of a Johnson capacitor. I'm sure you're familiar with the design. And I strapped everything together to share the load on all four terminals, and that solved that problem. The final problem was the parasitics. I ended up winding 2.5 turns of half-inch strap with a 470-ohm resistor on each coil for parasitic suppression. The thing is running 100%. Dick, I wanted to discuss with you, I'm thinking of taking another SB220. I'm finding a very good platform for building amplifiers for other bands, like the 6-meter job. I wanted to make one possibly for 2 meters. And I want to get a suggestion from you on what tube you would suggest. I was thinking of using a 3CX800, which is a triode, or possibly an 8877, but the 8877 is a little bigger than I want to go. I'm looking for something maybe about 700-800 watts, 900 watts DC on 2 meters. I'd like to use an 8874, but unfortunately that's no longer available. The IMAC no longer produces the 8874. And I wonder what you think about using a Pi network versus a strip line output. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW and 2EO.
Yeah, very nice set of questions there, Rich. One of the things that's not obvious at first until you start digging into how a high-power afterburner amplifier works is that you're always living with the biggest disadvantage all of those tubes have, and that is plate capacitance. You're putting the biggest voltage on the plate. In your case, it's probably something like 3,300 volts DC to operate the plate. And when you want full swing of RF energy coming out of that tube, you'd like it to see something in the vicinity of, if it's Class A, you'd like to see something close to 3,300 volts, peak positive, peak negative, so to speak, on that plate when the full RF energy is there. If you want full power output, you want full RF swing. Okay. You've always got plate capacitance, some number of picofarads. The tube that I remember most was a 4CX250B. I think the plate capacitance is something like 4.5 picofarads. It doesn't sound like a very big number. But when you plug in one over 2 pi square root of FC, that's the capacitor reactance. When you calculate the capacitor reactance at your operating frequency, you're going to come up with some number of ohms. Let me make a ridiculous example. Let's assume that your particular tube you chose happened to have a capacitor reactance of 300 ohms at your operating frequency. And you're going to be putting a 3,000 volt sine wave on that tube, 3,000 volt peaks, and it's got 300 ohms of capacitor reactance. By definition, you divide one into the other, 300 divided into 3,000, you're going to have 10 RF amperes flowing in and out of that plate, that anode of that tube, on each half cycle. So therefore, at first 10 RF amperes doesn't sound like a lot, but when you start adding skin effect,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you start adding the skin effect, and you realize that the RF energy is only flowing in the last 10,000th of an inch of the top of the copper of whatever is your plate resonator circuit, when you start looking at it from that point of view, you'll rapidly see where all that heat was coming from that you had in your previous experiment. You were taking a tube that was designed to be used up to 30 megacycles in the original design of the SB220, and when you use it at almost twice the frequency, 6 meters, you're going to get twice the plate current. Because the plate current is twice as high in amperes, and because the skin effect means that the depth of penetration is lower, a shorter number, when you go to the higher frequency, you got two things that are fighting each other. You got less copper doing the conducting, and you got almost twice as much current that's got to be conducted. You can see immediately how things get hot. The bottom line of all this is that when you get up to 2 meters and above, 6 meters you might get away with it, but 2 meters and above, no matter what tube you use, you calculate the capacitance, reactance of that anode, therefore calculate how much RF current is going to flow in. If you want efficiency, you're probably going to force it in strip line. In the case of the parallel kilowatt amplifier that I built, a pair of 4CX250B tubes, the anode resonator was 8 inches wide. That's what was required to properly carry the current with high efficiency into and out of those two tubes, 4.5 picofarads each, 9 picofarad total, and I'm driving them in parallel. If I tried to do that with very much less copper than that, double-sided copper clad, 8 inches wide, something would be getting hot and would be wasting power, if you know what I mean. So I think you're going to want to go strip line. That's the good news. Let me tell you one other thing. The bad news is to make a strip line resonator of the right width on 2 meters, that's easy. To make the strip line resonator the right length on 2 meters, that's going to drive you up a wall. If it was a half wave plate circuit resonator, half wave on 2 meters is something like 36 inches. I mean, in other words, that plate resonator wants to be 3 feet long in order to be half wave resonant. Yeah, you could make it quarter wave resonant, but then you're going to have a great big bypass capacitor somewhere, and you got to worry about the arc over of that capacitor at the kilowatt level, and that requires a lot of care. So strip line is going to give you the efficiency, but until you find ways of waving it around and zigzagging it, whatever, it's not going to be easy to live with. Now, there are a couple of hints. If you take a look at February 1970, Ham Radio Magazine, I had an article on an amplifier tripler with strip line all the way, operated on both 2 meters and 432. In that particular schematic diagram, you'll see that the plate circuit made out of strip line was folded back on itself in the plane, and therefore it was all fitted inside of a box that was, I think the box was like 12 inches long, 3 inches high for the plate circuit, and something like 8 inches wide, 10 inches wide. It fit into a standard-sized premier box. So by folding the strip line plate circuit, I was able to squeeze it into a convenient-sized box. And I think if you go to the Fred Merry articles, W2GN, Whiskey 2 Golf November, if you go to the archives of Ham Radio Magazine, amplifier made out of 250Bs with strip line on 2 meters. So from those two articles, you're going to get a lot of hints. And those two articles, you can both find them in the archives at QST Magazine. Here we go, Rich.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In my opinion, those two articles will give you a lot of hints. So I do recommend strip line, but you're going to want to fold it in some way to squeeze it in, because to make a resonator 3 feet long and put the whole darn circuit in the room with you is not very convenient. You don't really have to do that. There's at least 3 different ways you can fold that plate circuit, Rich, and we'll be discussing that more as time goes on. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, N2EO. I didn't use the original tank circuit. I used quarter-inch copper tubing, which I wound into a two-turn coil. And it's all silver-plated. By the way, there's a company called Texas Platers that sells electroplating kits. We're not talking about the this one-molecule thick silver that you brush on. This is real electroplating done with a, in this case, about 6 volts on the power supply. And I bought it through Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona. They sell the material, they sell the conductive brush. You hook one end to the work, one end to the brush, and you can electroplate. So everything is silver plated because of the skin effect. Everything is running good on 6, but I understand what you're saying on 2 meters, Dick. What I was thinking, I've never really designed a strip line, but I think I kind of understand what's going on. I've seen amplifier designs with what looks like a quarter wave straight strip line. At a quarter wave, it would have higher peaks at one point. So I was reasoning this out in my mind today. If you had, say, 1,000 ohm plate of peaks, and the strip line was hooked to the plate, at some point, you would drop to a very, very low peak. A quarter wave away, you should invert and get close to 0 ohms. That's where you put put a blocking cap between the plate and the strip line, ground the far end of the strip line, and then somewhere along that line, between the grounded part and where the plate is, you're going to approximate 50 ohms is where you put a coupling, like a flapper or some type of a coupling loop. Do I have the basic concept there?
You're quite close. If you were really tapping on mechanically to that line and the far end was grounded and the ungrounded end goes to the anode of the tube, yes, there is a point along that line which is the 50 ohm tap point. And now, finding that tap point and sliding your pickup probe, so to speak, along there would be very inconvenient because some days you want to match an antenna that's a little bit different than 50 ohms. You don't have to do that. The flapper capacitor allows you to have complete variable apparent electronic pickup point. In other words, when you have a flapper capacitor for output loading, you think you're just changing that capacitor. Believe it or not, electronically, you are really moving along that plate line. It doesn't look like it physically, but electronically you are. And you're going to choose a point further up away from ground, maybe the point where it's 150 ohms of impedance. And with the series flapping capacitor and the proper tuning of the circuit, it will perfectly match 50 ohms, for instance. On top of that, there's one other thing you got to know, is that the far end of the quarter wave resonator, the grounded end, is where the current is huge. And to put a real good bypass capacitor there, where you want the bypass capacitor to be small in physical size, so it doesn't contribute a whole lot of electrical length, yet be very high in current carrying capability at literally a microwave frequency. I'm calling 144 megacycles microwave. And to have it stand off your 3,000 volts at the same time and not arc over and not get dielectric heating, you put all of those constraints simultaneously on that grounded bypass capacitor on a quarter wave RF grounded resonator. It's a very difficult set of requirements that are essentially impossible to meet. You don't have to do it that way. A smarter guy will physically ground that by literally bolting it down to the chassis. The bypass capacitor doesn't have to be there. If you put the bypass capacitor right at the anode of the tube, you're feeding the tube DC-wise with an RF choke, but it in turn through a bypass capacitor is feeding the quarter wave resonator. That bypass capacitor up at the anode has one-tenth the current, so to speak, of the one at the grounded end, and it becomes a lot easier to do. The line itself has no B-plus voltage on it, so now the flapper loading capacitor, if it shorts through it by mistake, is not putting 3,000 volts up your cable. There's a whole lot of advantages of putting the bypass capacitor at the high impedance end, at the anode end. opposite of common sense until you realize what's going on. So that's if you decide to go quarter waves. You'll get a little bit more efficiency if you make it a half-wave resonator, but now you've got a stiffer requirement to fold it somehow so you can fit it in the same house with you, if you know what I mean, Rich. Fun type project. You're going to enjoy this one. N2EO, more power to you. K2RIW in the tech man.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW and 2EO, let's see if I got it. Yeah, when you said it, that's exactly what I was thinking. You put the bypass cap up the anode of the tube. Probably a couple of Central Lab 500 Mickey Mike transmitting caps in parallel. Come off with a quarter wave resonator, bolt the other end of the resonator right to the chassis. The only thing that's in my mind is figuring how long do I actually make that resonator, that strip line. Is it an electrical quarter wave? Is it, it's an electrical quarter wave, but what is the physical length? And then I have to probably do this the way I designed the Pi network on 6 meters using an MFJ antenna analyzer. In that case, I simulated the plate load impedance of the tube. Okay, I want to make sure I didn't time out. By putting about a 900 ohm resistor from the plate to ground with the tube VCC turned off, and then jammed an analyzer into the antenna and saw how it tuned, you know, on the analyzer. I guess I could do the same thing here, couldn't I, Dick?
Yes, you could, Rich, but you don't have to. Everything about that tube is in the data sheet if you're smart enough. The plate resonator would be physically exactly a quarter wave length long if the tube had 0 picofarad of capacitance and the tube is hanging at the high impedance end, the ungrounded end. Your real tube has got, let me pick a number, 8 or so picofarads. That extra capacitance makes you re-resonate the radiator, the resonator. You re-resonate it by making it physically shorter because of the capacitance you're putting at the ungrounded end. As you put more and more capacitance at the ungrounded end, you have to make it physically shorter and shorter in order to hit re-resonance. And I can give you a set of equations that will tell you exactly how much to shorten it. That's known. So what resistive impedance the tube is going to give you, the data sheet tells you that. What capacitance the tube is going to give you, the data sheet tells you that. Once you know the characteristic impedance of your strip line, how much it has to be shortened in the... You don't have to measure it. These are all known characteristics, and you can calculate it, and you're going to get within 3% of the right answer the very first time. Let me drop. And when it comes to the bypass capacitor you put at the anode, you could do it with doorknob capacitors, and that would work. A better capacitor would be a strip line capacitor. Your plate resonator quite possibly is going to be double-sided printed circuit board. And at a copper clad, cut a slot in the right place, and let the anode touch the ungrounded portion where you cut a slot. Now the capacitance between the printed circuit board upper layer and the lower layer is a thoroughly distributed, very high characteristic, very high quality capacitor, particularly if you use a good quality printed circuit board like a Teflon glass type printed circuit board. In other words, a distributed capacitor at the anode will have a hell of a lot lower stray inductance than your doorknobs. And it now will be a distributed capacitor that won't have point contact places of high current flow like the doorknobs will give you. Doorknobs will work, but you can do a better job. It'll be more compact, prettier looking if you do it with a distributed capacitor, and the printed circuit board is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it, let me drop, would be to make your strip line resonator out of a sheet of copper or brass, and when it comes into the vicinity of the anode of the tube, in that area, you lay down a sheet of Teflon sheeting, lay another layer of brass on top of it, hold the two together with nylon bolts, and now you've built an extremely high high quality distributed capacitor with Teflon as the dielectric, if you know what I mean, and you'll have a lot less stray inductance, and properly done, it'll look a lot neater. And when it comes to selecting where you put the loading flapper capacitor, believe it or not, you can put it anywhere from roughly the middle of the resonator up to the anode of the tube itself. Believe it or not, you can put the flapper capacitor anywhere along that length, and once you properly adjust tuning and loading, it'll all come out just right. That's a little bit hard to believe at first. There is no magic location for the flapper loading capacitor. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet Weimark, N2EO. It's very, very enlightening, Dick. This is a project I want to get into. You know, I'm sort of like laying it out in my mind over the last few weeks, because I'm finding these Heathkit SV220s. You tear them apart, they make a very, very good platform for building what I did was a 6-meter amplifier, and possibly, like we're discussing, a 2-meter amplifier. So, I want to continue this discussion of future weeks, Dick. Right now, I'm building a second 6-meter job for Barry N2MB, because he's been very, very helpful to me with antennas. One hand washes the other, so by spring, we'll both have kilowatts on 6 meters. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much, and I want to continue this. Maybe you can give me your thoughts next week, what you would use. I'm thinking of using a 3CX800. I don't think I have to go 877. I'd rather not use a pair of 4CX250s. I want to keep it down to 1-2. And I'm looking to get about 800, 900 watts out. I think I can do that with a 3CX800. I know that K1FO, who owns Lunar Link, is building real kilowatt amplifiers using a pair of 3CX800s. So I figured a single 3CX800 would give me somewhere in the vicinity of a kilowatt TEP output, which would be fine. Back to you, Dick, and go on to the next individual, K2RIW, TechNet Weimark, N2EO. Thank you.
Yeah, I also would go for a tube like the 3CX800. I like 4CX250Bs because they are, in the past, very readily available, very inexpensive, very high gain, very high power output for their size and dollars. The 3CX800, I'm guessing brand new these days, it's a $500 tube, whereas in the old days I used to be able to buy 4CX250Bs for $30. And so there's a bit of a trade-off there. One's a pentode and the other's a triode. 3CX800 is a beautiful tube. And by the time you iron out all of the details of what you're talking about now, this grounded, beautiful-looking copper strip for the resonator, the distributed capacitor at the anode, and using the nice power supply, you've got an SV200, 220, and so on, there's going to be a lot of other people who want that exact setup, Rich. If you wanted a source of income, I think you should consider manufacturing those amplifiers. There is a need for them out there. There's a demand for those. If the price is right and you got a good design that looks pretty, I know you would be able to sell them. I've also got some other comments on the subject of silver plating. Just putting silver on top of copper gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling that you've now got a silver-plated resonator. Let me drop. If you did a very careful measurement of efficiency before and after silver plating, you probably would not see any difference at all with good laboratory test equipment. And if you did see a difference, there is a slim possibility you will see slightly lower efficiency with the silver plating. Proper silver plating for RF microwave circuits is way beyond being a science, it's an art form. In order to get real fine grain size at the microscopic level on that surface, You have to electroplate on, electroplate off, burnish in between, use some chemistry in between. There's a whole elaborate process to do electroplating. If you just simply do electroplating to, let's say, 50 microinches, and you think you've now got nice silver plating on top of that copper, if you had a real high-gain electron microscope and you looked at it, you would see a whole lot of grains of silver making miniature mountains at the microscopic level on top of your copper, and the overall resistance of the silver would actually be higher than the virgin copper was. So just putting on silver, as I said, it gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling, but it doesn't mean you're home free. You'd be amazed how many people have fallen in that particular trap. We'll discuss that a little bit more next week, Rich. Okay, the next person who signed in was Ray. His signal was a little bit low in audio, but I think I'll be able to figure out what he's asking, and I'll repeat his question. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW. Wait for the three beeps, and you've got it, Ray.
K2YO.
K2YO recognized. Stand by a minute. Let's see. Ray, are you there?
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee. How's the audio now?
A hell of a lot better. We're going to hear you very well. Now, let's see. He probably has a comment on the previous subject, so I'm going to pick up Bernie first. K2YO, go ahead, Bernie.
Evening, Dick and Net. Negative. I unfortunately was caught on a customer telephone call when the Net started. I just need to get at the end of the line of the simple questions at the beginning, please.
Okay, we got you on the list. Ray, KC2, Mike Yankee. Your radio came up a whole lot. What'd you have to do, Ray? And go ahead with your question. You got it, Ray.
Okay, just had to jiggle the mic, something with the mic with this radio. I need to know, I guess, purpose of a BFO. Is there one in every single sideband radio? And is it necessary to hear the code, CW code, on single sideband? Do you need that beat frequency against the, you know, or would you be able to make it out anyway? So I guess it's really one question with three parameters, if you could give an answer on that. And I'm just going to listen, so I'm not going to get back to you. I'm going to lay on the couch and listen to the rest of the net.
Yeah, your audio is beautiful now. You made a hell of an improvement. You said VFO, then you said BFO. I think you're trying to say Baker, Foxtrot, Oscar, BFO, beat frequency oscillator, because you did say it later on with words, and thank goodness. Radios, like a Heathkit AR3 is the one I cut my teeth on in the mid-50s. In order to convert a Morse code signal into tone, you needed to add this extra oscillator called beat frequency oscillator. That's if it's a pure AM detector radio. However, if the radio already is made for single sideband reception, then you could say that the single sideband reception, which is the so-called product detector in there, automatically is the BFO. So every real single sideband receiver you will ever pick up, you could say the beat frequency oscillator is already there. You do not have to add another one. So the nice thing about a real single sideband receiver is that when you hear a pure key down Morse code signal and you grab the tuning knob on the single sideband receiver and you're listening to that signal, you will hear the tone change pitch. You'll hear it go, if you know what I mean. You'll hear it change pitch as you tune across the signal, and that's the normal operation of a single sideband signal. And by the way, if you set it for upper sideband or lower sideband, you'll get that sound that I just heard, either directly or inverse, if you know what I mean. You'll hear it one side of center and not the other side of center very loudly. You'll eventually learn how to do that. So you need not add any other oscillator on a true single sideband receiver. And just about every ham radio rig other than a purely FM rig you pick up these days, any multi-mode rig that can pick up single sideband will do a beautiful job on Morse code. You'll be happy about it. About the only thing, about the only thing you might want to add at some time is that a pure single sideband receiver has something in the vicinity of 2.5 kilohertz of instantaneous bandwidth, because that's how much bandwidth is required to allow the single sideband speech frequencies to come through the receiver. If you're a real serious Morse code operator and you only want to hear one Morse code signal at a time, you might want to be able to select a more narrow filter. So at later some later time, you might want to select a 1KZ or a 700 hertz or a 500 hertz filter that you can switch in